started. First up this afternoon, I will call back into order the recessed City Council meeting from the past Monday, July 17th. And I will note for the record, we have full attendance here today, so we have a quorum. We can move directly to our reports and recommendations, and item E1 is a decision on finalists for city administrator position. Sharon, did you want to cue this up?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I want to say a thank you to the City Council for all of the work that you did with the interview process, and also the fact that you were able to get back to me, and our plan had been to look at the preferences that existed among the City Council members and to move forward from that. And having reviewed your emails, I am pleased to announce that the candidate that received your consensus and first preference is Steve Reimer, who is currently the city manager in Morgan Hills, California. And so I think with that, you might want to do a motion at this point for some of the next steps.
Move to direct our committee of three staff members to finalize negotiations with Steve Reimer.
Should I bring the contract back to the council for its consideration?
Sure.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? I will say, as part of the process, it was very well managed. Thank you, Sharon, for leading us through that process. We had some outstanding candidates from across the nation, and we went through a very deliberative process, I think, and multiple stages. We asked a lot of tough questions. And I think we've arrived at a good selection in Mr. Reimer. So, any other comments?
Just excited, and thanks, I guess, again, for the entirety of the council. I echo that sentiment, and I would add, kind of looking forward to the next phase as we kind of welcome someone new to town and hopeful that the entire community kind of join us in going through this process. So excited to see the conclusion, hopefully, of the process.
At the conclusion of today's meeting, we will recess once again to the same time next Monday. That will allow us to hopefully take action and adopt the employment agreement. Mr. Russell?
I was just going to say that I echo Sharon, you did a great job. And, you know, this is really an exciting time for us. This is the first time in decades we've been able to, we've had this opportunity to fill this position, and there's certainly some big shoes to fill. So I think everything we've seen looks exciting and positive, and it's a kind of a new time for our city. So this can get worked out, and we can move this all forward. Thank you.
All right. Sharon?
Since Mr. Reimer is not here, I would like to say that he is incredibly excited about this opportunity, and I've been thinking about it, and just very, very pleased to have you all look at him with confidence to move forward. One thing he told me today that I think is sort of interesting and sort of bodes for the future, he wanted to let me know that one of the things that's coming up for him, he's been an active member of the International City County Management Association, and I think that's a really great thing because it's a source of ideas, and it really kind of reaches the stretch and the expanse for the city of things happening through other parts of the country. And he was someone who was asked and invited to become a member of the Sustainable Communities Committee. And so there is a conference, it's October 22nd through 25th. And he is excited that he will hopefully be in attendance, and he will be representing Rochester and one of the members of that committee. I know sustainability is really an important issue for all of you right now, so it just seems like it is setting things moving in that kind of direction.
All right. Anyone else?
I would just comment that Steve's coming in with it seems like very strong consensus. There were some other strong candidates, but overall he's coming in with a pretty good support from the council, and we are on many issues a very divided council, and I think that's tremendously important for us to move forward.
All right. If there are no other comments, I'll call a question. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries unanimously.
Won't have to learn a new name, first name.
I will not be able to be here in attendance next week when you have an opportunity to act upon an agreement. We will be getting information to you on that agreement just as soon as we possibly can, because I know that it's going to be important to you to just take a look at the terms of the contract and what's in it. But I just want to, again, thank you for this wonderful opportunity to work and to get to know all of you in the city of Rochester so well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. We have one tabled item, item I-1, for the second reading of the DMC Parking Overlay Zone Ordinance. Would there be a motion to remove that from the table?
So moved.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Campion, second by Ms. Johnson. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carried. We have this item, the second reading.
Were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, we tabled it to check on a couple of our currently in line projects to see if they were fitting within the parameters, just as a good check on the ordinance that we did that. It appears they are, so we're ready to proceed with that.
All right. Any other questions of staff? Go ahead.
For second reading and final passage, an ordinance creating and enacting sections 63.428 and 63.429, amending and reenacting sections 63.400, 63.410, 63.414, 63.421, 63.422, 63.424, 63.425, 63.426, and 63.427, and repealing section 63.423 of the Rochester Code of Ordinances relating to the Destination Medical Center District Parking Overlay Zone.
Move approval.
Second.
Motion by Mr. Campion, second by Mr. Bildebeck. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carried. I would now entertain a motion to recess the City Council meeting to 3:30 p.m. on Monday, July 31st in room 104.
So moved.
Second.
Okay. Motion by Mr. Ruska, second by Mr. Campion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? We stand recessed. Now we'll proceed with the remainder of our committee of the whole agenda. Item number two is the 2016 audit. Mr. Martinson, you want to kick this off?
Well, I just wanted to say we got our first, what we call our capital without care. Care was our previous assistant finance director that lived for 23 years or something like that. So our staff worked really hard getting this all pulled together for the audit team. And Rachel, our assistant finance director now, is sitting here behind me. But over Tom Wentzie from Smith Schaefer and Jason Boynton, who's going to provide the presentation, are here. And with that, I'm just going to turn it over to them. But I think take it from there.
All right. Take it away.
All right. Thank you. All right. Well, good afternoon. I'm pleased to be here. Thanks for having us. Today, I'm going to go through the results of the 2016 audit. Following the format that we've done, similar to in the past for those of our returning members, we've got the PowerPoint here, but we have issued the CAFR. Did this back in June, our firm, Smith Schaefer, and our employees, we performed the audit of the financial statements, and based on the testing that we did and the following the generally accepted auditing standards, we feel confident in issuing an unmodified opinion on the financial statements. A lot of people refer to that as a clean opinion. Essentially what it means is that we think that the financial statements are fairly stated in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. Should mention that a couple elements within the financials, the electric and water utility funds at RPU, as well as the DMCC, which is a discretely presented component unit, those were audited by other auditors. So our firm were the primary auditor for the government. We issued the overall opinion on the overall CAFR. But in the case of those two, we didn't perform the audit work. We were relying on their opinions on those firms that did those audit procedures and issued those unmodified opinions on those financial statements. And we did that in our overall issuing our overall. And City participates in the Certificate of Achievement Program, which is through the GFOA, the Government Finance Officers Association. So we submitted the 2015 CAFR last year. It gets reviewed for whether it meets the minimum requirements, and we're pleased to report that we did receive the Excellence in Financial Reporting Award. We submitted the 16 CAFR as well, and we certainly feel that that continues to meet the standards to continue to achieve that award. I think 2015 was the 45th year in a row that the city has gotten that award. So the city has always demonstrated consistent quality financial reporting, and should be proud of that. In addition to issuing the opinion on the financial statements, the city is required to have a special audit procedure performed under federal grant dollars. A lot of people call that a single audit. Well, that is currently in process. We're doing that currently right now, and we will issue our report on that prior to its due date in September of 2017. Based on past experience, we certainly don't anticipate any issues associated with those problems, but if something does come up, we would certainly bring that to council's attention. We met with the audit committee a couple weeks ago, reviewed these audit results and discussed in a little more detail some procedural items, as well as reviewed our auditor's responsibility letter. And I just want to thank the mayor and council president and administrator for participating in that meeting. All right, it's kind of just a brief summary of the audit opinion that we've issued. Does anybody have any questions about the audit specifically? All right, so we take this opportunity, since we have issued the CAFR here now in June, just to kind of take a look at financial highlights of the city over the course of 2016. And so we're going to look at several funds here. We've listed them all. There weren't any new funds added in 2016, so general fund is our main operating, and then we've got some special revenue funds where we track different activities. So we'll get some charts on most of these that we're going to take a look at the highlights. Again, the numbers come out of the financials. We're just summarizing them here on the PowerPoint. Now we're also going to look at proprietary fund types, which are account for things a little different than our governmental funds, more business type, full accrual type approach to accounting. The difference between the two, enterprise versus internal service, enterprise is outside customers that we're serving, providing services to. Internal service, as the name implies, the city is actually the customer on those funds. So I'm going to walk through these charts. I'm going to go relatively quickly because we're covering a lot of ground here. So if you have any questions as I'm going through, please interrupt me and stop, and we'll deal with it at that point in time. So most of the charts are going to be similar. We've got multiple years worth of history here. I'm going to concentrate primarily in 2016, since that's the year that we just completed and issued the report there. And in most of the charts, you're probably going to see the first column within that group for the year is going to be your revenue or your funding source or the dollars that are coming in. The second column is going to be your expenditures here. This is the money going to be going out. And then this smaller amount there is the change, whether it be an increase or a decrease for the year. So a lot of the charts are going to follow that guideline. I'll try to point out if they don't. All right, so taking a look at your general fund. So this first column here, your revenues, are bringing about a little over $70 million in the general fund. And operating costs were slightly less than that. Our funding sources within the general fund is property taxes there. You can see it at just under $40 million in property tax go to pay for those. Other revenues, which is going to be state aids and other fees and services. And then we get some in lieu of tax payments from the utilities that help to contribute toward the general fund budget there. So about $11.5 million, that's that section at the top. There's our expenses. We did generate a surplus of about $1.2 million in the general fund. Revenues increased $3.3 million. Our property tax levy increased about $2 million. We allocated about $1 million from the state highway fund toward the general fund public works projects. Some years we take that funding and put it in CIP as far as construction improvement. Expenditures increased a little bit more than revenues, so our surplus was just a little bit less than it was in 15, but we listed out here the individual departments, the increases in the costs associated with that. So we're experiencing a growth in the city, obviously growth in our general fund budget, growth in providing services up there to the community. But taking a look at your fund balance, then the reserves. So we had $1.2 million excess, which took our reserves up to $31.7 million. As a metric against expenditures, annual expenditures, that equates to about 45% of annual expenditures that we have on hand at the end of the year. So even though fund balance did increase, our fund reserves did increase because of the size of the budget increase as well. We're maintaining a metric there of about 45%. We're managing our growth, continuing to keep our fund balance at an appropriate level, which is above the city policy of not less than 5 months in reserves, which is 42%. Why do we have those fund reserves? Well, one of the main reasons we have is for cash flow purposes. So our main funding sources within the general fund, property taxes, and state aid only come in a couple times a year, in June and July, and then again in December. So we fund operations within the general funds. These are the cash balances by month. So you can see we dropped down from $31 million down to $15 million in cash balances. So we have to have that money on hand to pay for operations until the funding sources come in. All right, taking a look at special revenue funds then. First one is the library fund. Again, library is primarily supported through property taxes here. $5.9 from the city and about another $900,000 from the county on properties levied outside of the city. Revenues were up. We get a little bit of fees associated with it, but again, primarily supported through property tax support. Expenses were up a little bit. We did generate an excess there, about $139,000. Their fund balance that is at $2.7 million, or about 38% of their annual expenditures. Municipal Rec Fund. This is going to include all of these items, operations here, like Rec Center, Golf, Recreation Department, Gray Marina, all those. What you see here, this is the aggregate of all those funds. I got a couple of charts that breaks down some of the larger ones that we'll look at next. But again, overall funding, property tax support here, we get a little bit more user fees for the citizens that are using the facilities for that purpose. Expenses, the revenues were up, expenses were up a little bit, but still generated a surplus of about $480,000 and took our fund balance there up to about $3.3 million, which is about a third of our annual operating expenses within Municipal Rec. For the Rec Center, revenues, you get. So this is within that Municipal Rec Fund. We're just kind of taking a look at how we track these internally. We do put some property tax dollars in as well as user fees. You can see what we're putting in for property taxes exceeds what we necessarily need for operations. So we are generating surplus and setting that aside for future capital needs. From a revenue standpoint, you can see here we were impacted, I think, in 11 through 15 by construction activities out at the Rec Center. So in 16, we have more fuller operations as well. We did increase rates, I think, both in the pool and in the ice rental. So we saw an increase in revenues, which kind of built that surplus back up to what we were generating back in those pre-construction years. Gray Marina, they fund more of their operating costs through their user fees. And Gray Marina is a little unique because of our agreement with the county, where if there is any shortfall, we share that deficit with the county. So we had a small deficit, about $22,000 in 16. That was split between the city and the county there. Well, revenues were up a little bit as well as we increased rates at Gray Marina too. Golf operations, revenues were relatively flat. They were only up about $7,500. And after revenues in golf, we have levied property taxes about $160,000 to help support operations. After we didn't do as much levy in those years and weren't able to cover our costs there. So. Just small deficits, about the same in 16 as it was in 15. Maintenance of our park system. So we spend about just under $5 million to maintain our parks, primarily funding that through property tax support. We don't get a lot of fees on park usage, so we fund that through general property taxes. Did have an excess in 2016 of about $317,000. Civic Center, we broke this fund out from Municipal Rec a couple years ago. So we fund that here through an allocation of our lodging tax, about $1.5 million, and then user fees that we get for using to cover the costs. You can see costs were up a little bit, more levels than we were back in 2014. Another shift here, we used to allocate property taxes. We switched that to lodging tax in 2011. But we did start this fund a couple years ago, so we've been starting to build up a fund balance there. We have about $700,000 in fund balance within the Civic Center. All right, taking a look at the airport. So this is just operating revenues that we generated at the airport. So a couple things you can see here, obviously this commission line increased substantially. I think they were able to redo their car rental agreements there, and they were able to generate more fees out of their car rental agreements. We're also seeing an increase in land and building rent. That's now our second largest revenue source out there at $1.2 million. We got a little bounce back in landing fees. You know, historically we were getting more, but this activity had kind of declined. Number of flights, we were getting less dollars. But we did get to see a little bit of a boost there. But overall revenues are up within the airport. If you look at overall fund operations, so you can see that increase in revenues there. We do levy a small amount here, about $400,000 there that we've been levying the last few years. We did not have a levy back in 2009 through 13. And so we did generate an excess here. And when you look at this fund balance, that's important because you'll see the airport, we have a fund balance there about a little over $5 million back in 08. But when we stopped levying within the airport, as well as they were doing some capital needs, so we had to use some of those reserves, that fund balance had dropped to about $500,000. So I think there was an effort then to kind of turn things around and build that fund balance back up. So excess operations in 15, they took it from $1.1 million up to $1.9 million, just shy of $2 million in the airport. Our transit system. Transit's funded primarily through federal and state grants. Actually, we didn't levy any property tax support. And the increase, we're seeing increases in revenues within transit because they're increasing the caps on how much they expenditures that it will cover through federal and state grants, and then we get user fees on top of that. So you can see the combination of those exceeds our expenses, and now we've been building fund balance up. We got about $2.3 million in fund balance within the transit fund. This looks like a large increase here, but this was when we switched to a contract style. We used to do a cost reimbursement, so we netted out the user fees primarily, most of them. Now we're recording them both gross revenue and expense. The Bioscience Center, so the city has the Bioscience Center. This fund accounts for the non-TIP portion, which is the top floors, 4 through 8. What you'll see here is revenues in the green cover our operating costs in the blue, as well as the orange is the debt service, the transfer out for debt service. So what we're generating rental revenues there is covering what it costs to operate and covering the payback of the debt associated with the construction. Fund balance there is about $900,000. We have some debt service funds. Part of that Bioscience Center, we did issue about $16.6 million total in bonds associated with the non-TIP portion for construction. So we're using those rental revenues, collecting back to pay those down. And then we also issued TIP bonds for the TIP portion of the building. Those are getting repaid back through tax increment revenues. And so we issued that back in 2009. We got that paid down to about $7 million. So 13 and a half on one, seven on the other.
We pay off about 900 grand a year. So it's like paying off your mortgage.
Mm-hmm. Are those 20-year bonds or?
Yeah.
Back in 2011, we issued debt through the Build America, this was part of the stimulus program back then, to fund the Public Works Ops Center, $23.8 million, and then the Transit Ops Center, about $2.5 million, and the fire truck purchase. So this one's kind of unique because it's part of the stimulus. A portion of the interest cost is reimbursed by grants from the federal government. All right, so last year we talked about there's a new GASB standard that came out. That requires that employers are participating in a multi-employer pension plan. If that plan is underfunded, then each of the participants in the plan is required to record their proportionate share of that liability on their financials. Okay? So this started back in 2015. We had the information for 14, so we included that on here. Well, 2016 comes along, and we update our actuarial study. Well, they decided to make some changes in their assumptions. They changed their discount rate, what they used to calculate what that liability, the present value of that liability is. And by dropping that from 7.9 to 5.6 in the police and fire portion of the PERA, you can see it had a little bit of an impact on the amount of liability calculated. I guess that'll change.
Yeah,
I wouldn't have noticed.
The thing that you've got to keep in mind here, though, is we kind of consider this to be informational reporting. Okay, so we're underfunded at the that PERA based on these assumptions that they use to calculate how what benefit payments they're going to have to make, and they back that back to today's dollars, and then they look at that compared to how much we have on hand. Well, you can see if you change your assumptions, it has a pretty significant impact one way or the other, right?
My copy is pretty cool. I just wanted to explain, this is the PERA, it's run by a board of management. State auditors on there, there's four governor's appointees, there's four elected people. They had a bill in this year to start addressing this as they've had previously, and it was passed by the legislature, would have passed by the governor, but it was in the bill where they had the minimum wage thing that was intended to address Minneapolis's action or desire to change the minimum wage, and so the bill was vetoed. So they have a very responsible board that's got plans to how to address this, but we'll be back in the 2018 session. I would also point out, this is something that happens periodically. In a lot of the cases, it's addressed with a combination of some state funds. It's addressed with increases to the employees, the charges against the employee, the percentage of their wages that go into the fund. And also, it comes, there'll be a higher charge to the city as well down the road. It's usually, they do a combination of things. I think we've seen three of those in my career. And we'll be seeing a fourth soon if that bill passes. So I wanted to point out that they did have a bill in to already look at this. And it's a long-term process. They have a plan, and it's kind of addressed in there. So I just gave you a couple of sheets on what the board is and kind of what was in that bill, so you have some of that background information. Okay? Thank you.
Just to put the magnitude of that in perspective, that is about one-tenth, using the numbers that Richard Fries had for our streets, of what our unfunded liability is in street maintenance.
Well, if the liability is not addressed, the real liability is $234 million.
That's today's back-looking.
Right.
This is also forward-looking because it projects. So by the same standards, our street maintenance liability is 10 times worse.
So how this continues to work going forward, then they'll redo the actuarial study each year, and then we'll report our adjustment based on how the actual results came, based on what their assumptions were. And the reason I say it's informational, as Gary indicated, is that it might be an indicator that things are going to change down the road. They have enough money now to pay all the benefits. It's just down the road what they're thinking that they're going to have to pay out. We don't have enough on hand right now. So it's not like this is going to be an assessment coming down. The state's actually got it. Any questions on that? All right. Capital projects. So we have our construction improvement fund. We've got roughly about $99 million in reserves in that construction improvement fund at the end of 2016. It's down from last year, but we had funding associated with the Civic Center expansion. So we spent those dollars down, and we made significant progress on construction there with the Civic Center. But that $99 million that we have on hand is tracked internally and is broken down into different categories here. One example would be flood control. When we did that project, when we got the additional dollars in for maintenance, long-term maintenance of it, we put that into an account. We charged the maintenance costs against there on an annual basis, and then we keep track of it that way. Infrastructure sales tax projects, money that we've gotten in sales tax that we haven't spent yet. So you can go down the list there. We have about $12.4 million left on the Civic Center at the end of 16. Obviously, construction's completed. And I want to point out that the DMCC, the money that we're spending, the city's upfronting there, we are keeping track of that. At the end of 16, it was about $13.8 million. And I think the council has passed a resolution then to pay, basically fund themselves back those outlays, initial outlays, through sales tax collections, existing and amounts going forward. All right, enterprise funds. So enterprise funds, we charge customers what the cost of the service is, pay for our expenses, and then we generate an excess to probably set aside for capital. So in the case of parking, we collect user fees of a little over $7 million. Our expenses are about $5 million. So we generated an excess there of about $2 million that goes into our reserves. At the end of 16, we had a little over $22 million in reserves within the parking fund for future capital needs as part of that system.
Some of that will go for the current ramp that's under construction. And then we have a second ramp that may be needed down the road. So we have two in our system.
So is the cost of those future replacement ramps, where is that factored in? Is that just not tracked relative to the fund? Because I didn't see it under the CIP. I heard you make a statement in which I kind of object to, which is that the parking, that we cover the expenses.
Yeah.
But we only cover operating expenses, right? Not the future ramp. Perfect.
There is depreciation in here, though. The problem is a number of those ramps are getting close to being fully depreciated, if not already, and those were initially built by TIF dollars, so we didn't pay for them in the first place out of the parking of the downtown ones anyway. So this has been a conscious effort to try and build these reserves up, because we have both replacements to deal with and DMC type initiatives, which are basically talk about ramps out of the periphery for the future as well.
So okay, thank you.
I'm going to probably spend $8 million of that just to do the bonding for this ramp 6 that we're doing right now.
Right.
Okay. Electric utility out of RPU. So again, user fees here, expenses were up a little bit, revenues were up more. We had done some rate increases the last couple of years after quite a few years of no change in rate increases. You can see revenues were relatively flat there, but did increase from 15 and 16. We've also added on some additional customers, about 1,500. So that drives that increase in revenues, and essentially we increased the amount of net income that we brought in, about $18 million. The water utility, we increased rates 3.5% in 15, 6% in 16. After revenues were relatively flat there, and expenses had started going up above those, so that we did generate a surplus after 3 years of deficits within the water. As far as their reserves that they have on hand at RPU, with unrestricted cash investments here, about $40 million on a little over almost $150 million in expenses. That equates to about 31% of their GDP on hand as well. So electric did have a sizable year, but they also invested a lot back in capital. So that cash, even though they had an excess, it didn't really come back in their cash balances because they spent it on capital needs. sewer utility. So we've been increasing rates. I think we went through a rate study through this period here to increase rates to help cover the debt service on the expansion. Did another study in 15. That's going to cover rates through 2021, but we did see an increase in revenues. We're actually seeing a decrease in costs, and this is an interest component here. So while we did some refundings, we've been able to achieve some savings in interest rates and bring our interest, our borrowing costs down annually. So it's just lowering our actual costs associated with it and showing positive surpluses in 2015 and 16. But even from a cash perspective, with those surpluses, we've been building up cash reserves there as well. So we've got a little about $33 million in cash reserves within the sewer, which is 142% of expenses. But keep in mind, sewer expansions are quite expensive to do. So we're building up cash reserves for when we need those in the future. Stormwater, well, the revenue is about the same, but the mix of where it came from changed a little bit. This is our stormwater fees. We get some money from developers as well as they do projects within the city, and that was less this year, but the actual fees increased because we increased rates after not doing any rate increase for quite a while. So we increased our revenues, expenses, our net position. We had about $11 million. And this is, again, kind of a relatively new fund, so we're still building up our reserves within there for future capital needs within stormwater. Equipment revolving, so this is that internal service fund where we use this mechanism to charge individual departments, and the main reason we do that is because as we acquire equipment, the individual department budgets don't have to take that entire hit of the cost of the equipment in that year. We acquire it in this fund, and then we charge the departments out. What you'll see here is the departmental charges in the yellow haven't kept pace here with the actual. We've had larger expenditures for actual equipment, and you'll see what has happened is we've converted those, our cash reserves, into equipment, and so our net position has come down a little bit over the last 4 years. I got a chart in a second that'll take a look at that. We also have an IT, which is the same concept, but it covers information technology. Unusual item this year was the Civic Center expansion, so we transferred in some money to help pay for some of the technology enhancements that we did there. But from a net position standpoint, you can see information technology, their net position, what we've been charging is roughly what we've been acquiring out in acquisitions each year, but because we've been acquiring more, that balance has been coming down, equipment revolving. Now we're going to recover that because that's going to get charged out. So there's a lag. We'll get that charged out as they use the equipment, the new equipment, but that balance has declined about $4 million. Self-insurance, again, this is, we self-insure for primarily medical as well as work comp and property loss. So in the yellow would be your excesses. That's what we charge the departments over what our benefits paid out each year. So you see for quite a few years, we did operate at an excess and built that reserve from $15 million up to almost $28 million. But the last couple of years, we've had pretty sizable claims, larger than I would say normal claims. And so we've been using some of those reserves that we have built up. So we used up about $4 million. And then when you look at what we charge departments relative, but you can see those benefit payments out the last couple of years. So did necessitate a rate increase, revenues about increase about 13%. Although I think if you look historically at the market, what people are experiencing as far as premium increases relative to what the city had experienced for a number of years. I think you're in pretty good shape there. And us continuing to monitor the benefit payments as we go forward. All right, I just got a few more charts. First one looks at taxable market value. So this is what we can spread the tax levy over. So what this good indicator of is we've had growth in the community, obviously we know that. The economy kind of lagged off here. And we didn't experience much, and now things are starting to tick back up again. Kind of sets the stage then. We're a growing city, so when you're actually looking at real dollars and revenues, we are seeing some increasing property taxes to help fund our growth, as well as we've got other projects going on, so we get dollars through the sales tax, dollars through the lodging tax, so you can see the increases there to help fund those projects. Where we're not really seeing much for increases in state aid, LGA. So you look, and we've got a chart later that kind of looks at this, but percentage-wise, well, we're getting the same amount we got back here in 2009. Cut it in those years when they had hard budget times, and we got a little bit restored, but now we're just getting small increases. Oops. Other revenues, we get some fee for services, about $15 million. This is federal, state. This doesn't include LGA, but you can see that is up quite a bit. The state contributed toward the Civic Center expansion that's going through there. We got some money associated with turning back Highway 63 to the city as far as for future maintenance and so on. We talked about getting some savings on low borrowing costs, while on the flip side, on our reserves, we don't get much investment income either. So a little offset there as far as rates go. On the expense side, by department here, so again, growing city, costs associated with providing public safety, administration, airport, and we talked earlier about transit, that's just a change in how we were accounting for that particular contract. Park and Rec, we spent about $14 million in total, including the Civic Center. Culture, a little over $8 million, that's going to include the library. Public Works, we've been spending a little bit more through our general fund budget there the last few years as far as streets and highways. All right, so I mentioned earlier, we talked about that kind of shift between property taxes and state aids. So what we tried to do here is to take those two primary revenue sources for the general fund and factor out growth in the community, which we use population as a metric for that, so per capita, and then we use the CPI adjustment to try to bring all the old years into real dollars compared to 2016. So you can see, you know, back in 2007, the LGA, we were getting about $100 per person in today's dollars, and we're getting about $64 now, so pretty significant reduction in state aids coming in. So as most cities are doing, who are getting additional state aid, they're having to increase their levy to help offset some of those costs. I would say that, you know, overall combined basis, we are up since 2007.
Jason, we have a question here.
Fill me in what LGA is, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, local government aid.
Thank you.
So that comes from the state. It's based on a formula, based on a fairly complicated formula, actually.
But it's easier than it used to be.
Back when the state said they were going to have a state sales tax and they controlled the income tax, they said we'll share some of this back.
Yeah.
On a basis of need, the cities, counties used to have some too, they can bring them up. But it varies from city, and there's some weird factors in there. But we get much less than, like Duluth, for example, gets about $29 million, we get them over $7 million. Minneapolis, St. Paul get a lot more than we do. Because the biggest factor is the age of housing.
Okay.
If you have a lot of really old housing, we need to age our housing quicker. We're not one of the biggest winners.
Gary, let me ask you on the taxes that the state made in terms of the business tax structure this year. Does that only affect the state tax collections, or will that affect the local tax as well?
I think it will affect just the state tax collections.
Okay, so in terms of that chart that we saw of the property tax valuation, there's not going to be a new color introduced or anything like that?
No, I don't think okay. so for us.
Right. Thank you.
All right, now just a couple finishing up slides. So within the financials, we have the fund accounting, which is primarily what we focused on there, but there is this government-wide section they call, and basically it's a full accrual approach to the entire government, not just the utilities, as we've talked about. And so I just briefly want to point this out to you. So schedule, what they're trying to do is say, well, here's the cost, including depreciation and all that kind of stuff of all of our assets. Here's the cost. So for example, public safety, they say it's $60 million. Well, then we have revenues that we charge directly for the activities that help cover those costs, okay? And that's these grants and charges for services and capital grants to come to a net cost, so it gets public safety about $50 million that we have to cover, and we cover that through this section called general revenues down here, which is, you know, primarily property taxes and state aid, LGA, and other fees. So that's the concept of the statement. Then it comes down to a total, and it says, well, what's your overall change in net position? And so for on a combined basis between the government and the utilities here, we increased by about $47 million. So they're saying that as you continue to track this, and this is going to take some additional time probably, but might be an indicator of whether the assets of the city are deteriorating or whether we're reinvesting dollars and continuing to keep up with that. Now here, within a growing community like us, we would certainly expect to see value to continue to be added to that. Now, when you look at what those net costs by function, this is by year, so you just get kind of a feel, but a couple of things, just some unusual items, like in Public Works, in the year that we took over Highway 63, that was considered, we got the road back and we put a value associated with that. So we brought that all on as a revenue, which makes it look like it was positive, and we're going to write that off over the life of the street. But the biggest user is going to be public safety of our general revenues, followed up by, to some extent, Public Works and administration. Another thing I should point out is this increase from about $40 million to $50 million in public safety isn't really in real dollars. That's that increase in repair liability I mentioned earlier. We have to factor that cost into all these individual departments. So departments that have a lot of employees that have pensions, they get hit the hardest, and that's going to be public safety and administration. So that's the primary reason for those increases. That cost.
I'd say that's a little bigger than just administration in general government.
Yes. Well, general government covers all of the administrative functions, not the administration. Sorry. All right, quick summary then. Unassigned fund balance at 45% above our policy, good shape. Library at 38, 33. We started the Civic Center a couple of years ago, so we've excesses. We built that up to 700,000. Airport, we reversed that declining trend in fund balance, and we've got that back up to about 2 million. We continue to exceed our expenditures in transit and generating fund balance there, about 2.3 million. We're covering our costs and debt service in the Bioscience Center. We've got $99 million set aside for the capital projects as part of our CIP plan. Our parking fund has about $22 million in reserves for future capital needs. We got debt that we're servicing for electric upgrades, as well as paying off the last expansion at the sewer plant. And the rates that we have on sewer are covering those costs, and we saw we're building up reserves there. The benefit payments out in sewer, we're using some of those reserves. That's why they're there. That's why we have them. But we're at $21 million. We've got to continue to monitor that. Spending out equipment revolving there, we brought that fund balance down. We'll recover that over the next several years. PMCC, I did mention, that's a discretely presenting component unit, so because of our relationship with them, we do include them in our financial statements. The money that we spent up front, we will recover through sales tax collections. And we talked about the para liability that a significant increase because of the change in assumptions. We do allocate it out to governmental funds and enterprise funds based on how many employees participate, the proportionate share kind of like they do overall for the people. So. All right, any questions for me?
Questions? Mr. Ruska.
I think it's a really good summary of everything throughout in this report. It breaks it down. It's easy to see and understand. The one thing is, I don't recall getting this. Gary, is this something that we can get sent so we can just have it for a
copy of the phone?
Yeah. Just the PowerPoint, just electronic.
Right,
you know,
here.
Yeah.
Yep.
We'll send you electronic. And you can have electronic as
okay,
well.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. Is it on our website?
No, but it will be shortly.
Okay.
Wait till we get the final version from them because it's really their report, and we're sure it's done and we put it out there. Okay.
I thought that was requested in the past.
Yeah, it is. So one thing I just want to point out, that equipment revolving fund, part of it is, and Steve made a conscious effort to try and get everything up to date before you left, but that fund a lot of those reserve funds used to earn a whole lot of interest that it's no longer earning. And the theory was they pay us the depreciation charges back over time, and the interest earned on that would keep up with inflation, so when they buy the replacement, they'll be able to pay for that. Well, that hasn't worked for sure in areas like fire trucks. For some reason, they're fire truck costs go up well over what inflation has been, and certainly well over what we've been able to earn in interest on our allowable investments. And it's not the case either with a lot of the construction equipment that Richard's been buying to replace his old equipment. So I do think that that's something, I talked to Gary, that we, in the budget discussions, we may be starting to talk about putting some tax levy back into that fund again just to try and make up for the fact that we're not keeping up with inflation. It is true that some of those expenses we've been doing will start paying back over time, but it just hasn't been keeping up because of our investment returns aren't keeping up with the inflation, especially on some of the special rate equipment. So I just wanted to point that out too.
All right. Any other questions? Mr. Campion.
How about the self-insurance liability? That seems like another year of a big change. Do we forecast that basically just going forward, we're going to continue to face potential calls, and what's our response?
For foreseeable future, yes. And again, I've been around here long enough where we're small for a self-insurance group, okay? So we do tend to see these fluctuations. And when those years when we were putting money away and I was getting the pressure not to increase rates or to drop the rates, we said, no, we don't want to do that. We gave a one-month holiday or something like that to our employees because we were collecting more than we were actually spending that year. But I knew it was going to turn out and come back again. But this is the worst I've seen in a long time, so we'll be talking about that also in our budget discussions. And then we have a large number of people on the high claims list, higher than I've ever seen. And you'll see those same kind of red numbers next year, and we'll be asking for increases in premium rates.
mature before we kind of see that start to turn around again.
Does our self-insurance pool continue with the employees until they reach Medicare age, or do we...
So by law, we have to allow them to stay on our plan until they reach, actually, until 85, to be honest.
Okay.
But none of them stay that long. Most of them, once they do get Medicare age, leave because mm-hmm. they can find cheaper alternatives for a supplement than what we don't technically offer a supplemental plan.
Mm-hmm.
So most of them do leave at that point in time, but that's part of the OPEB liability. We have to calculate it out until essentially they die, but... So it usually isn't as bad as what that open liability says, but yeah, they can say that they pay the full premium rate, so there's no subsidy to pay a retiree's insurance. They pay the full plan rate.
So it just has we have the baby boomer bubble work through our workforce.
Exactly.
As they retire, it comes off of this fund.
No, as they reach Medicare age, they get off the plan.
Okay, so we do cover them up until Medicare through this.
They are in the plan, and their claims hit the plan, so they are paying the full premium.
Okay.
Ms. Johnson?
I just want to thank you for this report. As a person who is not a financial person, it was easy to understand and easy to read, and I appreciate how you put it together. So thank you very much.
No one's perfect.
Just a bubble.
Right. Just a bubble, but not this.
Anyone else? Mr. Campion?
No. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
If there are no other comments.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Moving on then to Building Safety Annual Department Review, Mr. Johnson. Gary.
Yeah.
We have a bunch more here.
Okay, great.
Thank you for the opportunity to meet you. I'm not going to do a PowerPoint. I've heard death by PowerPoint is really bad, so we don't want to do that. But with regard to the Building Safety Department, I will give you a little handout here that kind of summarizes some of the things that we're looking at. The Building Safety Department is made up of four separate divisions: Plan Review, Building Inspection, Housing Inspection, and then the Office Services. We have a total of 29 full-time employees. Two of those will be new inspectors that will be added this year because of the approval of the City Council last year. Appreciate that. We did fill one of them was a plumbing position. We filled that this spring. We're still in the process of filling the building inspector position. We had interviews last week and we're kind of finalizing our selection at that point. We've gone through a couple rounds to try to find qualified people in this market right now. It's very difficult, so I mean, we want to make sure we get the right person with the right fit there. Some of the notable accomplishments that we have in 2016 and the beginning of 2017 is in 2016 we implemented citizen access online inspections, and I took a shot of numbers of what we did in June of 2017. About 33% of our inspections are being scheduled online through our citizen access instead of accepting phone calls. So we find that's providing more efficiency. Our hope is to get that number up to 50, 60, 70% at some point. But the more people we can get on there, the better for us and for them. Excuse me. We also implemented online payments for our rental certificates. In 2016, we had 442 transactions for a total of 65,000. And in 2017, so far we've had, through the end of June, 430 transactions for a total of 56,000. So we're getting a lot of acceptance from our landlords paying their fees online, which is good. We're estimating we're collecting about 40% of the transactions for rental renewal fees through our citizen access. So. One of the things that we're working on at the end of last year and we finished up this at the beginning of 2017 is we digitized all our paper address files. We have an address file for every permit that we've issued. And within the file, it has all the permits, has may have a approved set of plans. So we digitized all that, and we have about 38,000 address files that we had uploaded into Laserfiche. It was about 1,000 old banker boxes full. We had quite a project. Our staff all kind of helped out on that, and we got that completed now at this point. We're rolling that over to our rental housing to hopefully get that uploaded. That's not that, the files there aren't that great. So
Are those going to be available through Acela?
They are. They're available through Laserfiche.
Okay.
Everything historically is available through Laserfiche.
Okay. Thank you.
So if you need access to it, we will send, I mean, we have homeowners that are requesting information or contractors looking for information. We now then send it to them electronically instead of having them come in and look at it. We still have a whole basement full of commercial building plans. We don't plan on digitizing it. The cost of our rental for our basement is peanuts compared to the cost of what it would be to turn that into digital files. So through this process, we've had to implement paperless processes. So now every permit that we issue, every receipt that we issue, is now automatically attached to Laserfiche through our Acela system. So we're no longer generating paper that has to be filed. It's all digital. Through that also through that process, we're also scanning our building plans for residential, always residential, commercial, small commercial, and permit applications, and all documentation is being scanned in and attached to the Acela system, which is available for the citizens to look at also. On the back of this, there's a couple of educational opportunities that we work with. We've worked with the Rochester Builders and do lumberyard meetings. This last year we did 3 of them where we talk about various things. I think the topic this year was the top 10 items that we're kind of seeing contractors struggling with. We find it as a good avenue to interact with the contractors, give them an opportunity. We also, in our lumberyard meetings, we had a couple staff from our IT department participate with that. They showed them how to use the citizen access, how to schedule their inspections, how to become a registered user, those type of things, and we plan on expanding that into more information. We also are participating in the Rochester Area Builders Home Show. Every year we have a booth. We share a booth with the fire department right next to us, so it's an opportunity to interact with the contractors and also the public and provide information such as handouts on decks and answer basic questions on what our processes are. Public safety, we do a public safety class once a year. Susan Laguerre, our manager of housing, works with the police department to coordinate that. We do that in April. That's a requirement of every landlord to be able to take a public safety class. We also provide that class because we only offer that class, in-person class, once a year. We also provide that during various times of the year to where they can take it, watch those videos online, and take a test to verify that they've actually watched those. But it's an opportunity to give them both an in-person feeling where the in-person part, they don't have to take a test, but the online version, they do just to verify that they've actually watched and consumed the information. So the second part, I have some handouts with regard to statistics. The first part is that the first sheets are our construction reports, which give our statistics, and the top one is a year-to-date for 2016. And I just wanted to show you that this is all information that's captured and is available on our website, has been available for a number of years. So go to our main City Rochester website, and you go down to the departments, and then you scroll over to the Building Safety Department, and there's a place where it says building permit report. And I was having trouble earlier, so hopefully it's going to, I don't know why. It gives you all the basic statistics regarding everything we've done in 2017, and we have archived reports going all the way back to 2002. So the top report, or the second report, is a year-to-date report, which is a statistical report based on what we've done so far this year for various types of buildings. So, All that is tracked in those reports. We try to maintain this information on our website and make it readily available because there's a lot of people that request that type of information so that they can plan construction projects, plan rental housing or housing projects, etc. There is also the low here is detailed reports that they will get, and they will get a report of every single permit that's been issued through the city of Rochester with the owner evaluation, basic information that's associated. So we also put this out in an Excel format where people want to download that, and then they'll do statistics where the growth within the Rochester now Southwest Northwest. So I mean, we're trying to provide them with the tools that they're requesting and make it readily available so that they can do that. So just kind of wanted to share that. The second part of what I handed out is this report, which is called our 2017 Mid-Construction and Rental Activity Report. And I can go through this in detail, but to try to be as quick as possible, I just gave you the basic summaries of each type. First page happens to be single-family dwellings. Last year, we ended up with 416 single-family dwellings, and this year, as of the end of June, we have 219. So we anticipate, you can see a constant growth. We anticipate that growth is continuing. And that same information goes across all permit types with regard to the type of growth that we've been experiencing, with the exception of new multifamily buildings, which is on page 3 of that report. We had a real odd year, let's say, in 2015 and 2016, where we had 1,156 units in 2015 and 981 in 2016. Our average before that was about 150 units, new units a year, and we've had those 2 years. We have a lot of multifamily buildings. We still do. I mean, so far this year, as of June, 213 units. We have a lot of projects in line for multifamily buildings. We've had a lot of development meetings, and that continues to grow. And to be honest with you, I'm not sure when that's going to stop. I mean, we need the housing. A lot of it's not the most affordable housing, but we are getting housing. So, I'm not sure if you have any questions regarding this report.
Mr. Gildeback?
I just have a question. It's not on the report. Randy, we talked about a rental checklist, and you and Susan and myself have met. Where are we at on that?
The rental checklist?
Yeah. We talked about coming up with some incentives for good landlords so we can concentrate on those who weren't so good.
Yep. We had talked about creating some type of an incentive program to try to incentivize. Right now, we make an inspection of every rental property every 2 years. So what we do is we go out, inspect it, we find a lot of deficiencies. If we can somehow make it so that the landlord or the property owner deals with those and knows what we're looking at ahead of time, then they'll make some effort to correct it. Right now, they wait for us to create a kind of a punch list for them to fix, of items to fix, and there's really no incentive in that. So Councilman Bilderbach and I Susan had sat down, went through some various things, some ideas with regard to a self-inspection, some ideas with regard to maybe give them a break. So at the end of, but the issue is it has to be a very specific inspection list so that we can rate them or grade them on how well they're doing. So that at the end of that inspection list, we can give them a grade and say, okay, you've got an A property, we're going to we're going to let you go inspections every 3 years instead of 2 years. Or you're a really bad property, you've got a D or an F, we're going to require an inspection every year, and we're going to charge an additional fees for inspection fees. It requires a whole restructure of how we're doing things with regard to a seller and how we're tracking those rental properties. So it's a lot more involved than just changing the ordinance and changing the fee structure. It's how we're going to deal with it in the future as far as providing some type of incentive. To be honest with you, we have a presentation specifically about that later on this year. We're going to have it on the schedule, and we're hoping to have more details in place. We're reviewing other cities like the City of Moorhead, City of Brooklyn Park, City of Minneapolis, that have done those type of things. City of St. Paul had one, but their checklist is very lengthy. And we want it to be user-friendly, but yet we want it to be able to achieve the goals that we're trying to achieve with regard to having them do their work ahead of time before we, and keeping their properties up to
So Randy, the numbers would indicate that you're obviously busy, staying busy, and I'm happy to hear about a lot of the efficiencies that you're deploying, a lot of the electronic kind of thing. But just in general, you know, one of the things that we hear about on and off, how would you characterize the development community in general? How is it getting better? Are the system efficiencies making a difference? You know, is that because I didn't see anything listed as far as one of your challenges in that area. I'm just curious what your assessment is these days.
I would say some contractors, some developers are getting really good at understanding what is needed to be done, and they're taking advantages of the tools and the processes that we provide. The example is a pre-development meetings. I mean, there's a lot of contractors that they come fully equipped with questions on what they need to do. We have a pre-development meeting with RPU, Public Works, Planning. Everyone's involved with it, and they can lay out what their development is at the early stages, and we can talk to them about what do they expect for our process. There are some contractors that aren't taking advantage of it. It's a requirement, so it tends to be after they apply for the permit, we send it over to zoning, they say you need to go through a site development review, and it's kind of an add-on thing. So I would say it is good if they follow those procedures. The other thing is, as they're getting busier, the quality of the plans that we're getting are, in some respects, are getting less. I mean, they're in such a rush. Their professionals are trying to just fit these things out as quickly as they can, and we end up spending a lot of time dealing with code issues in the planning view. That's taking us longer.
Well, I know you do the lumberyard meetings. You've talked about that, and I've been through a couple of these where you have some of your appropriate staff visit, for example, with the plumbers trade group and union. And it's an opportunity for your staff to share, here's some code changes you might want to know about, and then the reverse is they hear about things that are happening in the field. I wonder if those provide maybe an opportunity to educate the contractors, you know, here's a system, and here's how it can work for you and make your life easier. Maybe looking for those opportunities to reach out and educate all of the contractors.
Yeah, I mean, we try to take any opportunity, so if you have some other avenues that we could meet with people and do that, that would be great.
Okay. Mr. Campion has
another question.
Sure.
At what point are you recognizing them on this? It says building permit, so that's when the shovel's about to hit the ground, right?
Yeah, that's when they issue.
Okay, so prior to occupancy.
This is just the issued permit before. It doesn't deal with when we're closing permits out or when those are final.
Perfect. Thank you.
Sorry, I should have made that clear.
I was wondering if there is a metric for how long it takes to close.
Every project is different. I mean, we used to have it such that you could build a house and you'd have it closed out in 90 days. That's kind of a thing in the past. I mean,
right.
It's now 8-9 months.
Do we measure that? Do we care about that metric?
We don't measure it. We don't have the time to. Do we care about it? We want to make sure that we close in on all our permits, and we need to do a better job of that, of making sure that the contractors are going. We're finding out through part of, like, one of the challenges I put on there is our DMC report. We have to create a report of every project within the DMC boundary on when it was completed. So we're trying to follow up on this, making sure not every contractor calls for inspections, not every homeowner, or every builder actually calls for their required inspection. So we have to do a better job of tracking that information and getting them notified that they need to follow up with those types of things.
Sure. Is the technology helping in that regard?
It is. Some of it's not automated. We have to build things into it. I mean, we built an expiration date into our permit record that we can now, every time we schedule an inspection, it puts 180 days out. Because the code says the permit's considered abandoned if it's older than 180 days.
Okay.
So we have that metric that in place right now. Now it's a matter of trying to send some type of notification once your permit's about to expire. Send it out to the contractors. Maybe they just forgot to start calling for inspection.
Thank you.
Mr. Voigt,
who's these days? Who's principally doing the work on Excel? Are you still doing a lot of that yourself, or?
Yes. To be honest with you, it gets into some of our challenges. We have had two retirements of two key people within our department: a manager of planning review and their office service coordinator. Yeah. So, plus we're also very busy right now. So some of that is fallen by the wayside. IT staff, we have two, probably one and a half people from IT that are dedicated to working on the cellar. We still have workshop meetings every 2 weeks or every week to kind of go through what we're working on, getting online permits right now. There will be two different types of online. Right, we're working on an electrical permit that a contractor could just apply for and issue themselves, and we're also working on an electrical contractor that requires some type of review. It has to be linked to a building permit or something. So we're still making progress in that, I would say not as quickly as we would like because of the vacancies. We did fill one of the manager of plan review position, and he starts on August 3rd. He happens to be the manager of plan review at the state level. He's been there for 22 years doing that. So, I mean, we feel we got a really good asset there with regard to coming in, a lot of experience, and hopefully hit the ground running with regard to that. We're still doing interviews for the office service coordinator. Like I said, we're having a difficult time finding qualified people, and we're doing more phone screens on Friday, this Friday. So it's taking a lot of time away from me. Early on, with the retirement of the manager of plan review, plan reviewers were taking on that responsibility and role, but that kind of got put plan review behind. So I'm starting to go back in and putting plans in line, dealing with a lot of stuff there that I don't have time to do. But
one of the things we chatted about previously, and something that I understand you're in the process of hiring, very busy right now, but I'll keep my request standing for some sort of a citizen access type training program that someone like myself could get into, that just to try and be able to answer questions using the Excel of citizen access as opposed to trying to run everything through staff and just understanding how the system works. So
we do have the IT staff has created a number of help videos on how to do various tasks within that. What we discovered is it's kind of hidden off to the side, so just at our last workshop meeting we talked about putting that more at the top. Part of the issues that we have is within citizen access, not every area within that is editable. So to try to make it as visible as we can is what we want to do. So I mean, that's something that not a lot of people are taking advantage of those videos. A lot of times it's just easier for them to pick up the phone and call us if they have this issue with having their deals.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're going to get back to the fees, but you know, every year I like to ask the question, are the fees that we're charging for the various services, do we still charge less than or equal to the cost of providing every service? We don't overcharge for anything.
I would say no. I mean, one of these reports that I handed out was our expense and revenue report. We do collect more revenue than our expenditures. The issue is HR, finance charges are not built into
The county just takes like a 31% overhead or something like that to cover it, at least. So yeah, I mean that's the key thing is we want people to pay for the services they're using. We don't want to overcharge them. And I know it's always been our practice that we don't overcharge for fees.
Right.
So, and that continues to be the case.
Yes. To some respects, I think we need to be a little bit more forward thinking regarding that. I mean, when we're busy, we bring in enough revenue because of all the construction activity. When we're slow, the contractors don't want a fee increase because they're slow, and then we end up shorting on revenue. I think we need to build in incremental fee increases. We haven't raised our building permit fees since 2002, I think, and I still owe you a fee increase for our rental housing. Right now, I looked at our rental housing numbers this year so far. We're covering about 95%. Last year was 68%, and it's because all those large multifamilies are coming online. Which is helping with regard to that, but at some point we can't depend on it, so we're going to have to raise it.
Something that's on purpose, right? So you need another person.
Yeah, and a lot of the rental program is not all degenerated. That division deals with a lot of complaints, and the last page of this report gives you the breakdown of what we've done. It's a service request module that the city of Rochester started in 2015. So I gave stats on 2016 and 2017 and where we're at. And last year, we had 567 citizen complaints, or citizen requests is what they're called. And so far this year, 411. And so a lot more citizens are taking advantage of that. It's really easy. go online and actually create a user and for them to track or to submit a complaint. It gives them updates on when we follow up on it. So, I mean, it's a way to do it. A lot of times, if you receive a complaint from a citizen, that I think the easiest way to do it is refer them to that, and then they get instant updates on when we do things and when the issue's been dealt with and closed up. Other than that, I think I've taken up my time, but unless you have any other questions.
Any other questions? Mr. Hickey.
Hey, I just want to say thank you. It's an outstanding update. And I want to thank you and your staff for your responsiveness. I deal mostly with Susan, you know, with the property complaints and that. But I know you guys are kind of stretched thin, but your staff's always very responsive. And I know the citizens appreciate it. You know, you get citizens' complaints. We get those follow-up in a timely fashion. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Any other final questions? All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Moving on to our library department review.
Using a strategic plan. When we went out to the community and said, what's important? They said, if Rochester does workforce, being welcoming and inclusive, and do education well, if we do those things well, we will be a great community. And it's a national trend for libraries not just to check out books, but to do more around the digital divide, to do more around community engagement, those kinds of things. And Rochester is no different. So our goals in our strategic plan are to grow literacy, to engage the community, and build the infrastructure to be able to do the first two. So what I handed out today is a logic model. And why that's really important for us is that as we look at how do we talk about the value that we bring, typically, like at the state library report that we have to file, they ask, you know, how many books did you check out, how many people walked in your door? And that's all interesting, but it doesn't really say how we move the needle. How do we make Rochester a better community? And so we worked with Wilder Research to come up with how do we really measure what's important? And so as you look at this logic model, and this has been a journey, really is how do we ask questions that really get us to what's important? Do people feel more connected to the community? Are they learning? Are they better prepared for school? All of those kinds of things to talk about, are we doing the right things? Because we know as a city organization, we can't do everything. So how do we know what are the right things and how do we know whether the programs are effective? And so that's what you have in front of you with this logic model, and it really fits in with the strategic plan. And we're starting to do surveying, and we'll continue to do more. You'll see some of it as I go through the presentation, but you'll be seeing more and more of this as we go forward. So an example of growing literacy. The Rochester Reading Champions program continues to grow. We've got 27 tutors out in the community working with our low-income adults and students. Everybody is making progress, and that's what's really exciting. And we continue to add people every year. In fact, there's training going on right now, and there will be additional community members who will be tutors in the Rochester Reading Champions program. Our ebook usage continues to go up. Last year we put the books on the fly at the airport, so there is both a download station as well as a mini library out in at the airport, since there is no bookstore there. The mini library program continues to grow. Last year we added 40 more mini libraries around the community. We support 185, meaning anybody who signs up for the program, whether they got the mini library through us or not, they can just call us up and say, give me a box of books. And in partnership with the Friends of the Library and the generous community that donates materials to the library, we provide materials to get out into the community. And so, for example, 83% of the mini library owners report an increase in neighborhood connections. They're talking to their neighbors around the mini libraries and feeling more connected in their neighborhoods. And they read more when those mini libraries are in their neighborhoods. Engaging the community, we continue to see increase in our programming attendance. And, you know, we're at over 12, almost 1,300% increase since we opened the building. And even year to year, we're still, since we did our strategic plan, we're still up over 200%. So we continue to grow every single year as we do more and more programming in the community. The book bike. So this year we've added the art cart as well as the book bike. So now when you're out in the park systems, Thursdays on First or the farmer's market, you will see not only the book bike, but you will see an art cart where we're doing an art activity to be created. And even though you think everybody knows everything about the library, 56% of our visitors at the book bike learn something new about the library. That book bike allows us to have conversations in a very different way when we're at the book bike than when we're in the library. And so that's good for our community. We have a legacy grant-funded program where we have a sound booth in the library, and we're working on creating oral histories. We're in partnership with Homestead County History Center. RCLS is also part of that. Some of their students are learning from those stories, and that is a program in progress. Parents Empower Pride, as part of our creating a welcoming community, we have a Parents Empower Pride group. And 100% of those parents say that they're more connected in the community, they have a larger support network, they have more tools to support their child, and they've learned something new. So that's really an important piece of how we are a welcoming community. So again in that, we have our safe space training. As we have become the go-to place for how to create those safe spaces for our teens, people in the community are turning to us and saying, how do you do it? And we're bringing in nationally known speakers and asking the youth services community to engage, and they're showing up at training. We had a session recently where we had slots for 30, and I think we finally cut it off over 100. I mean, we kept growing and growing that program. So there's interest, and it's really important for our entire community that we build those safe spaces. The Ready to Lead program continues at the library. That is a community collaboration. We're doing two cohorts a year, one in the spring and one in the fall. And so we are training people on how to be on boards. What does it mean to be on a board? What are the expectations? And the goal is to get people who are traditionally underrepresented on boards onto boards. And we do a lot of networking to get people onto boards in an area that they really care about. So that continues. We partnered with the Diversity Council to host the Human Library at the library, and that was a great event. Another way we do it is we have community or English conversation groups. So we partner with UMR. UMR students come over and help. We have some community volunteers as well, and we host a safe space for people to practice their English skills. And there was a nice article in the Post Bulletin recently about that, and that's a program that continues to grow and really is a way for us to continue to help people feel more connected into the community. We also have story times in Spanish as well. And we have an amazing group of volunteers. I cannot say enough about our volunteers. Last year we had over 25,000 volunteer hours. And they're doing some amazing work, both in raising funds for the library as well as in providing services. but it's over $600,000 worth of value of our volunteers. And we continue to build our infrastructure. So we upgraded our Wi-Fi. Public libraries across the country are the number one place that people go to get internet access who don't have it. Rochester is no exception. And so we upgraded that and made built some faster internet. And those sessions continue to increase. And they're in the building applying for jobs. We have a lot of that happening at the library. And in 2016, we investigated and we started this hotspot program in January. And so we're really excited about it. We're doing it in multiple parts. So people can come in and check out hotspots so they can so they have internet access if they don't have it at home. We also are partnering with Olmsted County Community Services, and we are making sure that some of our lowest income residents have access to the internet. And so we're partnering with them on that, with Workforce Development and IMAA. They're part of that partnership as well.
Campion, do you want questions during this, or would you prefer I hold it?
I'll do it however you want.
This program is really exciting to me. Mm-hmm. What is the rate of checkout of those devices, or can we get some information on that?
Sure. Okay. There are several different programs. So, for example, the one with working with Olmsted County, they are checked out permanently to those.
Okay.
We're partnering with them, and they are selecting the low-income families.
There are some to check out. Though.
There are some to check out. There is always a waiting list.
Okay.
There has, since the day we started, I didn't check today, but there's usually at least 30 people on the waiting list at all times.
Could we 80. Get some information? Yeah. 80?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have more
we
questions,
also
but
have
I'll, for the rest of the council, I'll suffer in silence.
No. But we also have a hotspot with a Chromebook. So if someone does not have a device, they can also check out them packaged together.
Yeah.
And we also have some rentals. So if you know that you're going on a business trip and you need to have internet access at all times, you can actually rent them, and those we charge a fee for.
Okay.
Because you're reserving it for a specific time period.
Okay.
Or if you're on vacation and you have kids that you need to entertain in a car for a very long time, yeah, that's another
options
way, another option.
Okay.
Yeah. But I can get you some additional statistics.
Yeah, maybe I'll reach out with my questions rather than let you go into a void. Thank you.
Yeah. We continue to have great support from the Friends and the Foundation. About 4%, almost 5% of our revenue comes from sources, other sources, grants, Friends, the Foundation. And that does not include the volunteer time. That's just the funding. We continue to do community partnerships, Cradle to Career. I had another 3-hour meeting today. I will be sending you an update on that. And Strive Together will be coming back in August, and so I'll be sending you some information there. We'd love to have a representative from council attend that meeting, but I will follow up on email. So that continues to be a really great partnership and one that we're continuing to really look at how do we improve our educational outcomes because it's so critical for our community. And so then, within our building infrastructure, marketing continues to be something we continue to have to work on. We're learning all the time that people don't know everything that's available at the library, and so that continues to be something we work on. As part of that marketing, this year, to go with our strategic plan, to be more about more than just reading, and it's more also about community engagement, we have the summer playlist. And so it's a summer reading program. This year it's for all ages, so adults are participating, as well as from birth really to any age. And so what's happening on the summer playlist, not only do you get prizes for reading, but you can also get prizes for going on an adventure, finding a mini library, talking to your neighbors, doing things that really build community. And so that's going on right now as we speak. And we are an award-winning library. This year, I had told you at a previous council meeting that we became a finalist for the IMLS National Award. We did not win that award, but we were a finalist. And to be a finalist on our first application was really an honor. And we were also the UMR Community Partner of the Year as well. So some of our challenges. So some great things are happening. A really strong team at the library. I cannot say enough good things about them. Staffing continues to be an issue. You will see that in the five-year staffing plan. And most of that, the staffing requests are really about the increased usage, both in terms of the building itself, when we have more people gathering, it's harder on the building, and also the amount of programming that we do. We have a staffing request there. Budget. A couple things you're going to see in the budget this year. There are some costs for IT integration. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been, they like libraries, and so we have had deep discounts as we've been out on our own on IT, but as we integrate, we move into the city licensing plan, and that is going to be a significant IT increase for the library. We're committed to being part of the IT integration, but you'll see some jumps, and it looks like the plan is to step those in over the next few years. We also have some long-term maintenance issues, like this building had roofing issues, we do as well. Gary and I have been working together, and in the CIP this year, we're putting some money aside, knowing that it will take us multiple years to build that fund to be able to handle some of those issues. So rather than trying to do it in 1 year, we're going to try and get some funding to do it over several. And of course, space continues to be an issue, and the plan going forward. At some point, we would love to continue to have those conversations about what's the way to go forward. And we have library board members here in the room. Amy Ward is our board chair, and Olivia Truesdale is our student representative. We always have a high school student on the library board, and they're there, and we look forward to working with you on dealing with space issues.
Questions, Mr.
Wojcik? In terms of, I've been in there a lot of times where rooms have just been absolutely packed now. And in the short run, it's going to take a few years to do anything really addressing space, but we also provide a pretty substantial subsidy to the Mayo Civic Center next door for rooms that many nights are sitting empty. My question is, how far in advance would you need to know of the availability of a room or be able to program a room in order for it to be helpful for the library program and if you were to expand their space?
90 days or less.
90 days or less. The reason I bring that up is, again, it's taking from one pocket and putting it in another, and the fact that we are getting such a big subsidy to that, it seems that we should be able to benefit from rooms that are sitting empty. Are those conversations going on at all, or this is just something that's not being discussed at this point?
It had been discussed. So far, we haven't found a good solution to that issue, but we've talked about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fact that the rooms are sitting empty and there's a need across the street is, it seems that there ought to be a path forward for that.
It would be a pretty big, in the same way that you had the conversation about moving this meeting, it's the same conversation.
That's fortunately we get to control the budgets for both organizations, so we can make that decision. And
we would be open to piloting it. Obviously we've had that conversation and we're open to that conversation.
With such a huge amount of usage going on at the library, and some of the rooms now are kind of tucked in the back because that's where there's space that's available. What is your process for receiving and responding to accessibility concerns?
All of our meeting rooms are handicapped accessible. I understand that some of them are a little harder to find.
Yeah.
Meeting room C is down a staff hallway. I totally get that. But we have not had complaints about people not being able to get to meeting. At least I haven't heard them.
Okay.
So, but we do. We'll make sure.
For those concerns, just have people contact you directly then.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, you mentioned the staffing a little bit and the major maintenance. What is the timeline to when some of these major maintenance items, whether it be chillers or whether it be roofing, when's the cutter? Fisher cut bait line.
Well, in our planning, we did a five-year we did a five-year estimate, hoping that they hang tough through that. That's not to say that the chiller won't go out before then, but that's our hope that we can. I mean, this year we're putting in a separate air conditioner into the IT area. Because if the chiller goes, it will be months before we can replace it, and the IT infrastructure is way too important to not be able to run a computer system. So we have, it will be awful, but that's currently our backup plan.
All right, I know I run into you all over the place, so I'll save the rest of my questions for some other time.
All right, any other questions? Thank you very much.
You thank you.
Sound like you're also very busy.
Yes, we are.
Good. All right, moving on. Any other business for this afternoon, Mr. Wood?
Just something that I threw out. I think I sent a note to Councilmember Ruska at one point about this, but you know, one of my frustrations is always when I hear time and time again how unreasonable our development fees are, and simultaneously see that many of them are not even covering the costs of providing the service. And what I had suggested back then and what I'd be willing to back in the future is if the RAB is really willing to be our partners in this, I would support a full study to analyze and quantify our fees, shared 50-50 by the City of Rochester and the RAB, and just to keep this discussion going, because this talking past each other that your fees are unreasonable versus while we're just covering our charges isn't solving the issue. So if it's something that they're really concerned about, you know, we can all put some skin in the game and figure out if there's something we can do better. And it doesn't require any action today, but just something to think about, and I just wanted to get that out there publicly as well as an option.
Somebody has asked for, I don't know who it is, but we fill out this has come up many times.
All right.
State legislation.
Yep.
Yep. So we've done this development report that does actually cross allocation. Mm-hmm.
I think so. Yeah.
I think Matt LeBeau was working with the RAB, but yep. That was 2 or 3 years ago.
No, it's only been in the last couple of 3 weeks.
Yeah. Okay.
That's so we come up with that again, and we show what the costs are, and we usually, well, because again, we subsidize a lot of this with tax dollars,
yep.
Right? So in the end, it basically shows that we aren't collecting those fees really to cover the costs.
And if there's truly something that's inefficient about our processes that could be done better, well, this is something that a study like that could get to. But in order for us to pursue this, I really want everyone to have skin in the game.
Well, and I think that's a good point. I just want to get past talking in generalities about it. Like, if there's something specific, I'm all aboard. Let's go after it. Let's figure out how to change it. But it seems like we're at the point now where we need specifics on what parts of the system do people see as being challenging. Let's go try and figure out how to fix those pieces instead of talking in general about how long it's taken or how expensive it is to do permitting. Give me specific actionable pieces and we'll go after them. I'm all aboard that.
So there might be an opportunity or at least one forum. Are others aware of the RAB? I think it's an update on the development discussion. Next Wednesday, August 2nd, I was asked to attend anyway a Rochester Area Builders process update. It's an early morning meeting out at the Kaler Event Center. I'm not sure, I haven't seen an agenda or anything like that, but that was the topic, is process update. So I assumed that it was going to be an updated discussion about these kinds of things, and this could certainly segue into that idea or discussion of you know, fees and appropriate.
Could you send
it to administration
and get that sent around? Yeah. Be it, even if the result is just asking them to summarize it and give us a summary of it so that we can understand, I think that's a good forward progress on that.
Okay, so what are you looking for specifically?
If we could get a summary of what they discussed at the event,
sure.
If we're not able to attend, I don't know,
yep.
August 7th or 2nd, I don't know what my agenda is.
Yeah, I didn't receive a formal invitation. It was John Eichen that said, are you available to attend this meeting?
Yeah.
It's a 7 a.m. meeting. So.
Nope. Answer that one real easy.
Well, that kicked out a couple people.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Okay, what's their thoughts on kids?
All right. Okay. Any
Mr. Newman sent around a note asking about our position, our position on the shared positions, as big a mouthful that is. And I had a passionate discussion with Councilmember Hickey, kind of observed it probably as we kind of talked a little bit about this. And I just wanted to reiterate for the entirety of the council and frankly for the public my position on this, which is that calling this a shared position is just, it's stretching to the farthest extent possible the reality. When we're going to cover the salary and benefits for a position, I have a really strong displeasure with the idea that we're going to completely fund all aspects of this, but not have organizational authority over the individual. I think it sets a very challenging precedent for future hires, and also gets us in this weird position where we may have to budget for a position we no longer feel is justified. The agreement going forward with the county about funding is going to continue to be challenging. And I feel like it's a way to avoid the bigger question for the city, which is, what is planning going to look like? Instead, we're kind of continuing to go down this path of planning will be a function of this joint department of which we are partially responsible. I think that if they are asserting that these are city functions, then we have to take a real hard look at what the value of co-locating city-only functions is with county functions. If the effort is about the benefits of efficiency of these positions, then can we really claim that if everyone is asserting these are city-only functions? I find it really challenging to make that argument, and I find it really challenging to suggest that we burden future councils with further indebtedness to the county organizational structure. I would implore the rest of the council to consider an alternative, such as housing these positions under our administration, and taking that step to say, we want to be in charge of our resources, of our future development efforts in the city of Rochester. I think it's a good statement, frankly, to make to the entire community, which is, we're taking economic development and the future of our urban and other economic projects very seriously. And I would hope that everyone considers that. It took about 25 minutes to get through that the first time with Councilmember Hickey. And in respect for the rest of you, I would love feedback. I understand that sometimes this can feel like you're blindsided by someone making a passionate plea, but as that note came out, I felt like I would be shirking my responsibility to not at least bring up that should be considered.
Why do you propose to do that?
Well, City Administrator Interim Newman, I think my first statement would be to basically say that the cost share arrangement that they're proposing is not acceptable. We're going to shoulder all of the new burden, and they're going to shoulder costs that they're already incurring, and call those costs, which are not fake, I'm not trying to call them out as lying, it's just that 30% they're already incurring. Do we generally agree with that?
Oh, yeah.
And just like we have office space, we could incur that as 30% of ours and charge them 30%. I just think that is a really challenging argument to make and call it a shared resource. We could house them in 104, would be an option, and would that then count for 30% of the total cost of that employee? I don't think that we should just let this go through without discussion about where this sets us in long term relative to our goals and frankly our budget. There's some assumptions made here about the priority of these positions as well. So when we get time to, if we agree now to add two or three, we're kind of setting ourselves up for that, around the end of September, we'll be making hard decisions with one hand tied behind our back. So it's something that I think we should be really deliberate about, I guess, in my estimation.
Okay.
So the big picture for me remains that there are needed skill sets in our planning
apparatus that do not exist today and remain needed. And I don't think the note back was necessarily a reflection of where I thought the discussion was going. I thought it came back much poorer towards the city of Rochester in terms of what was being proposed. I think that they are really stretching what is a city-only function, particularly when they have needs for urban architecture skills at places like Grand Park, and they claim that there's no need for those skills whatsoever. Small area planning. I sent a note, copied Mr. Newman on it today, about some small area planning that needs to be done, and there's just no resource for it right now. So my preference is if they're sticking us with the bill for any of these folks that they want to claim are truly city-only functions, then let's have them part of the city apparatus and figure out why it doesn't fit under planning and reevaluate what's covered in the shared planning department.
Mr. Newman.
Yeah, I'll tell you my perspective, and that's based on some of the discussions I've had with all of you individually. I don't view this as the end of the discussion, but it's certainly it's an interim step that I do support. And the reason for that is I do think there are some skills we don't have that we need, and they'd be good to get them in to the whole mix of how we view projects and planning projects. I view it, in the long term, the city's gotten very good coordination and great service out of the planning department, even though they aren't our employees. I give a credit to all of the heads of that department over the years. They've been great to work with. They have a real urban understanding and an urban desire to create a great city. So I've always found that in the planning department heads that we have, and I think Mitzi's a good example of that, as was Phil and others before them. So I'm not too worried about the fact that they're housed with planning that we're going to lose control of them. I think they'll get better supervision, frankly, there in that area than they would with our staff. I mean, we have a good staff, but they have more expertise in planning than we do. We work with them every day on issues, and we have a really great relationship with the planning department and have always had that. Whole 34 years here, so I'm not too worried about that. My biggest concern is I think they were misunderstanding that all of these positions that are needed for the future are for the city, and they're not. I think we clarified that there's only a couple of positions that are really things that people could point to, such as the positions Michael mentioned, the urban design planner, the small area planner, and the transit-oriented development planners. Those really are, they might not be totally city functions or city efforts, but they're pretty close. I mean, there's certainly greater interest for us in that. I would love to see it still say all the positions are paid for by the county tax base, because our citizens pay 70% of that. That would be my preference, and that we get all these positions. But my fear is we're going to keep hassling in the PASC about getting these positions, and I'd rather at this point would say that we should probably go and get them in this manner. And down the road, though, if there's more positions needed, which Mitzi's list certainly says there are, those should be consolidated planning functions, and that should be resolved through PASC. If that can't be resolved, where there's no future commitment for the county to increase their cost for planning, then I think the whole issue would come back again, because I think it's not an issue you're going to resolve in the short term, and in my view, this was a good way to move the needle forward, get some of the services the city needs, get them under the planning department, and do the best job of supervising them, with the understanding that this is not forever. I mean, you could change this year to year at this point, but I thought on an interim basis this would be a good way to go. I'm the last one who wants to throw more positions in the city budget, because I know it's going to be a really tough budget year. And so it will be, we'll be putting one position in there this year, and hopefully one about 2 years after that, if you go this way. If this is not your consensus, I'm happy to go any way you want. But I'm looking for something that is at least a short-term solution, and not one where we're sitting here 2 years from now talking about the same thing, trying to get the same skill sets, and not having it. That's my two cents.
I would agree with you that this shouldn't be misconstrued as the end of the discussion. I think we were all feeling a need, well, planning department obviously feeling the need for more staff, period. We were being more explicit in some staff that would help some of our projects in direction. So this was a way to move forward with this funding model. Is it ideal? Probably not, but it was a way to at least move the ball forward. So, Mr. Campion.
I guess I would ask that, so you brought up a valid point, I think, about the county making future commitments to funding the department. And I think that's the sort of thing that any agreement we would make should contain, mm-hmm. is some understanding from the county of what their future commitment is to funding the department. Because this, to me, is how we get started down the path of the city shouldering significant additional burden relative to the planning functions. And we've gotten no explanation of what the county's future plan is for funding this. And if now we start putting our positions in there, you know, we're going to get locked into this discussion frequently, be my concern. And the second part I'd add is, you talked about your ability to function collaboratively with planning, which I agree has been great. But I don't see any reason why the reporting structure of these positions should influence their ability to work efficiently and effectively with the county. You know, that's not a problem for public works. That's not a problem for building safety. I think we have plenty of examples here of our departments working cross-organizationally and not having to be in the same reporting structure to be able to do it. Now, some of the other stuff I have to admit, germane concerns about the future of the departments, but I think that there's reasonable middle grounds here that just taking back the first pass of the county kind of saying, here's what we want to do, and not pushing back and saying, I at least want to understand the future funding implications you guys are suggesting here relative to additional positions, or frankly, cost increases in existing positions. What's going to come back, you know, so I'll leave it at that. That's probably sufficiently expressed.
I would say we got a comment in our note saying that the PASC will still need to address how the remaining six positions listed by the planning director will be addressed as county consolidated planning positions.
Okay.
So we have that comment in the draft I provided you.
Okay.
Mr. Bilbeck? First of all, I disagree that these are all city positions. The fact is that Rochester already's got its boundary, and a lot of these growths are going to be outside Rochester. They'll be on the edges of the Stuartville, Byron, other cities, and just areas out in the city or out in the county. They need these positions as much as we do, because you're going to look at how to put one community or one subdivision into another subdivision, and they're going to need to have people who can plan that. That's not all going to be within the city of Rochester. I believe that in the conversation that Mr. Wojcik, myself, Mr. Brown, and Ms. Cascaden had, that was agreed upon, and all of a sudden we backed out of that, and it's our responsibility. The fact is, transportation, we have people in the city of Rochester working on transportation. This transportation person needs to be the person who helps us connect with other communities around Rochester, not in Rochester. And so that is a part of the county. The county should be the people helping us bring these together, being the mediator to bring both the cities around Rochester and Rochester together to figure out how we can do transportation in this county and region in the future. So I get a little put off when I hear them say that these are Rochester positions. These are positions to help the region, which is the county, also grow and become better connected and make sure that they're economically feasible going into the future. These are not just Rochester positions, and I thought we made that really clear. I know Mr. Wojcik and myself did when we had our conversation, our small groups, and somehow, somewhere, things have broken down. All of a sudden, it's the city of Rochester again, and that's fine. We need these positions, but then I think that they need to understand that if they're using them, if they're taking these positions, they need to help us. And Gary, you make a great point. Rochester pays about 74% of the county taxes.
And that's one of the reasons we talked about maybe in the future a more sophisticated, you can implement a chargeback model where regardless of the staff, whatever projects, whatever work they're performing, there's an easy mechanism to charge back. And so Stuartville pays for what they use, Rochester pays for what they use, et cetera. that was viewed as maybe a future item. Yeah.
Not to get too far off on a tangent, but wouldn't it be wonderful if we simultaneously applied this to the sheriff's deputies that only work outside the city of Rochester and make sure that those positions are entirely funded by the non-Rochester budget? Because that would have a pretty astronomical effect on the county tax levy if we did that.
So all I was trying to drive to is maybe queuing this up for a discussion, but I realize we've gone through a majority of the discussion tonight. I defer to the guidance of the majority of the council, but I do think that it's worth hammering.
And that's
more.
It's hard to get that without bringing it, bringing something. Maybe bringing the latest version of the letter with some of the discussion we've had here today. Back to the next committee meeting for us to actually have us hammer out language that we can at least get a consensus on. And if we don't get a consensus, vote on it.
And I'd like to understand where everyone is. And I realized I'm blindsided today. Let's talk about it a little bit. And I'm open for phone calls. I'm sure the staff will answer that. But I think coming up with our position as a council is imperative to continuing to have a frictionless relationship with the county. If we all know what our agreement is internally, then there's no friction between us and the county because we're all on the same page. It is or it isn't. But what I didn't feel like I had consensus on was everyone understanding where I'm coming from as we do the discussion. So
what's the action? Do you want to bring it back?
I certainly can do that.
I'd like to do that.
I can tell you that I have not read the email that you sent because I was gone. So I got back at midnight last night, so I've not even looked at it. It's on my list.
That's good.
So that's why I probably look like.
I'd like to discuss more.
Okay. So we'll bring that back. Good. So I have one other real quick thing. I just want to plant an idea for you. Yeah. We're implementing some new ordinance and procedures for outside agencies. As part of that, I would like to, and I've talked with the city attorney about this a little bit, I would like to consider us implementing a new committee, an outside agency oversight committee, similar to our audit committee. So we could appoint 3 council members and maybe someone from the finance staff. Their charge would be on that quarterly basis to receive those financial reports, review them. I'm trying to think of ways to make this more efficient, basically. In concert with that, and this is the reason I talked to the city attorney, we might be able to reduce our memberships on some of these groups. We would still be obligated to do some where there's a state law that required mandates or maybe a contractual, but some of the others, I think that answers some of the concerns I've heard that we would just as soon be at arm's length from these groups. Mm-hmm. So it addresses that membership issue, but also for the sake of efficiency, maybe consolidates that review. Rather than having all of those potential agencies come to a committee of the whole on a quarterly basis, and take that time, treat it as an offline activity, like we do audit or something like that. Don't have to decide, and Terry said he would have some more thoughts to share on that. But so policies, the membership.
I appreciate that, and I think that would get largely to the heart of what my concerns were.
And that board could always bring it to the council if they saw something that was concerning.
We'll formalize that and talk more about it at a future meeting.
Awesome.
Right, one more thing. Thursday, you guys, come on. Show up for the cow thing.
Is there a dress code?
No dress code.
Should we formalize it as a cow meeting?
See, what this bribe me, I could have recessed the meeting for Thursday at 10:00.
Right.
That would have been a veteran move.
Wow. Taking advantage of the rookie.
Yes, we did. Hope you weren't looking for a denial there.
So next time, I'm bringing her in.
Who's
that?
She'd be better behaved. I just want to check with you.
We have Sharon meeting the review process, and all we really did is she called each of the council members to
I was just wondering about it because I've had.